first if you want.
I don't. Yeah, I'll be one more.
All right. I'll start with you.
Good morning, everyone. I think we're going to get started here in just a second. Let everybody wander over to the table. Okay, well, good morning, and welcome to the new division's roundtable discussion with microfilm digitization vendors, and thanks for being here so early. I hope everybody knows there is coffee. I'm Lee Foyer, the News Research Director for the San Jose Mercury News, and the purpose of our session this morning is to have an open-ended discussion with several vendors who are developing and marketing digitized newspaper microfilm archives. And I know I'm going to mess up that phrase at some point, because it's a mouthful. So you will get the chance to ask these folks questions about their evolving technology, market plans, and specific projects that they're working on. So why are people interested in microfilm digitization? Well, imagine this. You're researching a historical project, and every word ever printed in your publication is searchable with the click of a mouse, whether it's from 1950 or 1850, whether it's from an article or an ad. And no more loading loads of microfilm and searching day by day, which I know we've all done. In the last several years, this scenario has moved from dreams to reality for a lot of publications, and there are now a number of publishers and libraries that are working to digitize historical material and make that content easily available online. What did I do? Sorry about that. I don't know.
Wait,
does Mike be doing that?
I'm not sure. Technical difficulties. Hold on. Don't mind the man behind the curtain. The reason we're focusing on microfilm today is that for most publications, we will have a record, and it usually contains the most complete chronological record of paper's history. So its completeness makes it a good candidate for conversion to a digital medium. And I think hopefully many of us would agree that digitizing the paper's archives is a worthy and hopefully profitable goal, because there are many people who would like to have the access to the historical content of paper, and I think it would make a lot of people like their junk joy. But digitizing microfilm can be technically complex, it can be time-consuming, and it can be costly. There are numerous issues involved in conceptualizing such a project, finding the money to do it, researching the technological options, ensuring that the data is portable to future systems, handling out copyright issues, marketing, but despite the difficulties, more and more people are undertaking such projects, and there are a variety of ways to do it. Some of these libraries are taking a do-it-yourself approach with a scanner and a refill and creating searchable email documents. Some choose to do smaller, selected projects that will really time frame of historical importance to their own area. And other papers are using vendors such as these to do major projects in decades. So there's really a gamut of projects out there. So today we've got four stage panelists from several vendors here to answer questions. And just to note about the structure of this panel, I'm going to introduce everybody, and then they're each going to have a few minutes to introduce themselves as well. And then we will open it up to questions from the audience. So I will start. And we are being audio recorded, so I'm not sure if the mic is picked up as well, but hopefully it should be. And there is a handout by the door in case you missed it. Starting right here, we've got Barb Beach. Barb is the Vice President of Publishing for Historical Newspapers at ProQuest Information and Learning. Her areas of responsibility cover historical newspaper digitization, including ProQuest Historical Newspapers product line and the National Digital Newspaper Program, as well as microfilm publishing and contracting. Barb has been in the Library of Publishing for 25 years, working with all formats, such as print, film, and electronic, and many market areas from schools and special libraries. And a word about ProQuest. ProQuest Information and
Washington Post, the Christian Monitor, the Washington Times, the American Constitution, the Globe, as well as many others. And then her right is Rema Narn. Rema is the Vice President for New Product Development at VIA, the Division of Research and Development. Rema was formerly Vice President at Yale and publisher at Paxman Bio and Greer Educational Corporation. A little bit about REDUX. REDUX has been around for more than 50 years, and they publish collections of primary source research materials in academic libraries. They started out as REDUX Microtech Corporation in 1998, and they've been a division of REDUX. Today, REDUX is creating web-based research tools such as the Archive of Americana, which is a family of digital historical collections containing books, pamphlets, broad science, newspapers published from 1639 to 1820. They've also got most of the newspapers published in America from 1690 to 1820. And Rummel's focus is on developing new collections to add to that, to the Archive of America. Is that good? Is the mic still working? So Rummel, now it's really loud. So Rummel is writing material specifically for the period 1820 to 1922. His right is Chris Kelly, who's Vice President of Sales for Olive Software. Chris has had a long interest in photography and graphics and began publishing a consumer general interest magazine in the 70s called The Connection. And this experience helped to bring him into the technical side of the publishing business, and he's been working with that ever since. He has marketed and sold high-end photo typography and color imaging computer systems, and has specialized in both magazine and newspaper projects. And he was the sales director for the publishing division of SciTech America for several years, and joined Olive in 2004. And on his right is Scott Fisher, who is an account manager for newspaperarchives.com, which is a division of Heritage Microfilm. Scott joined Heritage last year as an account manager focusing on business development. Prior to that, he's with an educational software company and is also a business and human resources consultant. And Heritage is an archive and microfilm company that provides filming, scanning, and storage of historical documents. Heritage's sister company, newspaperarchive.com, is an online database of historic newspaper pages. They've created a searchable database of over 37 million pages of microfilm newspapers from hundreds of press and some foreign publications from the mid-1700s to present. So those are our speakers today, and now they're each going to have a few minutes to say whatever they want, and then we'll open up to questions. So far, for me to start.
Good morning, everyone. Still working?
No.
Thank you for asking me to be here today. We gave us wonderful instructions to speak for 3 to 5 minutes on what's new, which is always a really fun topic to talk about. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about what's new in the press, and then a little bit more about what's new in the world, and I'm sure my colleagues on the digital page will, the colleagues on the panel here will have very interesting thoughts on that as well. Just to pick up, Lee mentioned the historical newspapers that we have digitized for microfilm. We continue on that model. It's a large part of our publishing program. In addition to the list that Lee had, what we have added more recently is the Hartford Current from 1764 to 1984, the Chicago Defender from 1909 to 1975, and the Zealand Rivers from 1893 to 2000. Zealand is a very small town on the west coast of Michigan, and a large stretch. Settlements and population, and a resident of the city died, and he funds the library, and the library decided that the Howard Yale Public Library decided what they wanted to do was provide online digital access to the Zealand Record, their hometown newspaper, to everybody in the city. So we digitized that for them, and it's now for free to all residents of Zealand and the city government and all the schools. And it's a wonderful little paper. It's both in Dutch and English, and it's on the same, in the same sentence. I just offer that to give some idea of the scope of the publishing program. And let me mention briefly, I was speaking at another conference recently, and the question I got about this point was, why are you here? Because we thought that you sold off your newspaper like the film business. We did not. Our company, National Archives Publishing Company, bought the periodical microfilm business, and they are also a center of great expertise for newspaper digitization and microfilm digitization. We have a very strong relationship with them, but ProQuest retains microfilm, newspaper microfilm, and collections microfilm. The other kinds of things we're doing with digitized newspapers is we do have an interface for the K-12 market that provides contextual evidence around the paper, so it's easier for people to search who maybe don't know what Prussia is and have a school assignment that relates to it. We have really good products coming out of the online, and these can help provide revenue streams and cost recoveries back to the copyright owners and material. And we continue to grow this program. New in the world, which I'm sure that, or newish in the world, which I'm sure the other speakers will refer to, is the National Digital Newspaper Program. There's a session on that later this morning, as I understand it, which is a grant-funded program by the NEH and the Library of Congress to digitize newspapers from across the nation. It's an extension of the film program that was in place for 25 years. There's also many, in the world, many national digitization programs. The British Library, the National Libraries of France, Canada, and Austria, digitizing indigenous and local newspapers. There are more people getting into the business every day, more institutions, more vendors. It's very exciting. Even with the large British Library project going on, I think some of you may have heard on May 25th, something called the Library Newspaper Cooperative launch in England, whose goal is to provide online access to every historical newspaper and history archive in the UK. I don't know much more about it, but it shows you the activity. I'll finish with just a couple of examples of, I think, where the action really is, which is for the people who are using this material. It's just stunning. You can imagine having at your fingertips access to words, phrases, events you want to search. But I think what's happening is now that there's a corpus of digitized newspapers out there, and it's been there for a while, people are understanding new ways to make connections among things and going beyond original facts. I was speaking with someone who was using the digitized Chicago Tribune. The merest of clues, kind of forensic research, merest of clues and names and odd little facts to track down the history of the first policeman killed in the line of duty in Chicago. There wasn't a news story about this. You had to go back and find allusions to certain things. And he was successful about that. I had a scholar using the Los Angeles Times tell me that he and Dashiell Hammett would have gone to Hollywood to be a screenwriter. And in the first 20 minutes of searching, he found more information than he found in the last 10 years. He's a very good scholar. He knew a lot about Dashiell Hammett. But what was important was not so much the facts, but where they appeared in the gossip column, celebrity columns. So he was able to get a new kind of information about Dashiell Hammett. And then just yesterday in the hall, a librarian came up to me and talked about using historical newspapers to trace the, and I should say these weren't just ProQuest historical newspapers, to trace the impact of a massive earthquake in this country that occurred in 1812. And it was, of course, covered in certain newspapers, but they were able to link certain facts, like it caused mysterious tolling of church bells. The earthquake was in Ohio. Church bells tolled in New York and South Carolina. And they weren't attributed to the earthquake at that point, but in her research, she was able to determine and trace the path of this earthquake from the newspaper reports. So that's the fun part. That's what it's about, and I just offer those examples to keep us all reminded of what's the core of all this enterprise.
Next is Remel Nunn from UDEX, Division of Newsbank.
Dr. Elser, having some trouble with our sound system. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Am I ringing in your ears? No. Yes, I'm Vice President of New Product Development at Redux, a division of Newspec. I thought I'd say just a word about the relationship between these two units of the company. Basically, as most of you know, all of you perhaps, Newspec is an aggregator of domestic and international newspapers, with some 2,000 newspapers being published. Fewer of you may be aware that Newspec is also an e-commerce partner with more than 800 newspapers to figure out a way to commercialize some of the parts of the newspaper's backlogs. Even fewer of you may be aware that Newspec has partnered with more than 25 major newspapers to digitize their deep backlogs, back to the founding of the newspapers, and to figure out ways to partner and commercialize that material. The companies have been partners for some 20 years, but Redax itself goes back more than 50 years. Last year, we celebrated our 50th anniversary with the American Antiquarian Society, where they've been microfilming for 51 years on early American imprints and early American newspapers. Our early American newspaper project is basically the attempt to locate and digitize all of the newspapers listed in Clarence Brigham's History and Bibliography of American Newspapers in 1690 to 1820. Last year, we finished the first iteration, if you will, of that product, with about 70% of the titles, page count and whatnot, that's in Brigham. There are 2,000 titles in Brigham. We digitized about 1.4 million pages in iteration one. We're moving on now to digitize papers in all 50 states. Brigham, of course, up to 1820, was an eastern U.S. Product. We decided at the request of our advisory board to, rather than simply finish Brigham, and focus on the 1800-1850 period. We're coming all the way up to 1822, so we're dealing with hundreds of newspapers all the way to California. The relationship here is that just as Newspec is, if you will, drilling down into the back files of contemporary newspapers, what we're doing is coming up from 1690 and actually adding a great deal of depth to the contemporary newspaper databases. Not many existing newspapers in the U.S. go back into the Brigham period. When you think of some of them, like the Baltimore and Philadelphia Inquirer would, but even that paper, the third oldest existing newspaper in the U.S., only goes back to 1829. In an early American newspapers project, we've got 31 Philadelphia papers that go back to 1719 as the deepest. So we can provide more than 100 years of prior detailed historical material, even to papers as old as the Inquirer. So the way the companies meet is just right there. We can provide existing newspapers not only with their own backlogs, but with the historical context with their communities, drawn from hundreds of early American newspapers, and also from the fact that in early American imprints, which is cross-searchable with early American newspapers, literally got every book, pamphlet, and broadside published from 1639 to 1820. So in addition to 31 Philadelphia newspapers, we've got some 30,000 books printed in and out of Philadelphia. So Newspec is able to draw on its digitization expertise, its newspaper aggregation expertise, and on Redex's sort of microfilm-based historical expertise to provide deep context. The bottom line being that partnering with Newspec means partnering with someone that can provide a nationwide deep historical database and is a partner not just to digitize one's material, but to commercialize it in a partnership.
Thank you, Ronald. And next is Chris Kelly, and I just realized that when I introduced him, I forgot to say a word about Olive Software. So let me just say a word about Olive Software. It was founded in 1999, and it provides XML automation technologies that convert text, microfilm, and PDF content into rich XML format. One of Olive's publishing solutions is an archive module called Active Paper Archive, which digitizes archive materials such as microfilm. It's some of its projects include the archives of the Scotsman, the Daily Oklahoman, and the Philadelphia Inquirer's Civil War archive. Unless I just took away what you're going to say, sorry.
just about getting ready to say all that stuff. Thank you for having me. Good morning, everybody. Just to talk a little bit more about Olive Software, we're quite a bit different from the companies that I'm representing you with my colleagues. We are not an aggregator. We are a technology company founded out of Israel. We're based in the United States in San Francisco, where we support well over 300 customers worldwide and with a variety of products. One of the products, is, which we're going to be talking about today, is the Archive product, where we digitize content, analog content, microfilm, paper, through our what we consider to be a very specialized software. But we have other products as well. We do electronic replica editions of daily newspapers and magazines all over the world. One of you, maybe you've seen this, maybe you subscribe to it, the Washington Post, certainly as their daily edition is accessible on the web. And one of the unique things about Olive Software is that we're able to take that daily edition and combine that content into an existing historical archive. The Washington Post, for instance, has their archive. It's not available to the general public, but it's available to their editors and the writers behind the firewall. And so that's a very interesting component of our technology. Today we're going to be talking about this kind of stuff. If everybody's seen this New York Times magazine article a few months last month, where they're talking about the universal library, the universal search library, everything is going to be digitized. And I look at all this stuff from a sales perspective, being vice president of sales here. And where is it all going? What's the unknown? And when I think about this group, and I think about the projects that you all have and what you're going to be doing with your content, how are you going to monetize that for your publisher? Certainly from my perspective in talking to newspapers all over the world, the biggest thing that the newspapers are thinking about and librarians is, well, how am I going to make money doing this? How am I going to get an ROI from my publisher? What am I going to do? The technology is out there. We all have this technology. Digitization technology is out there. But how am I going to make money off of this? We work with private libraries. Brooklyn Library is one good example. And they get funds from the National Endowment, from the Humanities and other grant sources. So there's really no ROI. They take that content from the Brooklyn Eagle, that's maybe a historical newspaper in Brooklyn, and they make that available to the masses and outside of the market. But there's really no ROI to that. Take the Philadelphia Inquirer, for instance, where we've done a historical Civil War archive. How are they going to make money on that? How are you folks going to make money on your archive? And that's what we see all over the world. That we recently we've seen competition, especially in the UK, for marketing historical content where there's a lot of rich history. And we see that trend happening here in the United States. And it's certainly one of the things that we talk to our prospects about the Kennedy assassination and Watergate and relevant historical things that are going on in this country. So I think the trend is happening now in the United States. You folks are certainly all looking into it. How are you going to make that content available to your local markets where it's probably going to be the most profitable, tapping into that local curiosity just from the local schools who want to know who might be doing a project on, when the town started, when the first road was built, and things like that. Daily Oklahoma is certainly an example of a very profitable local historical archive. Their archives go back into the mid-1800s, and they make that available through subscriptions. And they sell ads around that. They have sponsors, and it happens to be a very, very profitable archive. But that's not the case with everybody. So from your perspective, what is the unknown? It's very much of an unknown. At least that's what I think. And I guess we're going to talk about that stuff today. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. And finally, we have Scott Fisher from Heritage Microphone.
Well, the first thing I need to say is I want to apologize for my general manager not being here. He sent me as a rookie instead, since he's getting married on Friday, and his fiancée decided it was best that I came. So, like she said, I have only been with the company for 9 months, and I am an account executive, so I am kind of sales-driven. I do know a lot about more of the microfilm side than I do the digital. However, I've been working with them over the last few months. As far as Newspaper Archive is concerned, we do have a couple of big, like Chris was saying, co-marketing sites where we can generate some revenue for the newspapers. Syracuse Post-Standard is one of the big ones. I'm currently working with the Stars and Stripes in Washington, D.C. I have a meeting with them tomorrow, and we're actually digitizing all of their content from their film. One of the things that Jeff Kiley, who's the general manager who sent me here, wanted me to let you know right now is we are going to be starting for K through 12 markets as well as public libraries and historical societies. We're going to invite them all to take advantage of a new program. It's Access Newspaper Archive. We are going to be doing all content for free to them from 1759 through 1977. So that's one of the things that is going on with newspaperarchive.com right now. Of course, there's premium content that will be available later. Again, I don't have a whole lot more to say as far as the background aspects than my colleagues here have had to say, so I'd be more than happy to let us move on and take questions. And if anybody has any questions afterwards, I'll be more than happy to talk to them specifically about my company, but I think we're here to learn more about the general process about what's going on.
Thank you, Scott. So there is a microphone set up for the microphone set up right in the center there. So if you could ask your questions through that, so that would be great. I don't know if anyone wants to speak up and get it first. If not, I can certainly jump in and move on to the question. Okay. Oh. Is that a question, or are you going for more coffee? Well, one of the things that I'm curious about, since my paper has not done the digitization project, is how long does a typical project take, and sort of what's the general process that you undertake in doing it? So I don't know if anyone wants to peek in there. Chris?
We generally do, when a newspaper or an art or a library has decided they want to do this project, they identify the source material, which is the microfilm. I'll give you an example. In the Suffolk Library System, where there are about 60 libraries across Long Island, they don't know if the microfilm is turned to vinegar or not. So in their historical documents out in Sag Harbor, they have a Bible and they have an Algonquin. Who knows what that looks like? So what we do is we try to work with the head librarian or the head technology person within that group, and we do a microfilm analysis or a content analysis. We actually send some of our technicians out, and they spend some time with that person, and they review samples of the content so that we know in advance of what the expectation is for search results, because the search results are always going to be contingent upon how good the input is. We like to make sure everybody's expectations are in the right spot. So that's where we start up. There's an identification process, a million pages, 500 reels of microfilm. What do they all look like? Where are they coming from? Are they in a vault? Are they masters? We just did a recent project in Australia for the Sydney Morning Herald, and we thought it was just going to be peachy. And we got the microfilm. It was 10 millimeter, it wasn't 15 millimeter. It was glued together backwards, so you're going from page 1 to 10, and then from page 10 to 1. And to try to put that in our automated microfilm reader and have the results come out perfect is just impossible. So we had to go back to the publisher and go through the whole process again, send reels back, and get the masters, and yada, yada, yada. So that's what you can probably expect, that kind of thing.
How how long does it take once you actually start the digitizing?
It's a very simple automated process. There are very high speed, high quality microfilm readers out there, microfiche readers. That to me is it's an issue. Everybody wants to know how fast they're going to get the results back. Okay, but once it's there, once it's in the pipeline, it's very, very fast.
I would just add that the biggest variable there probably, well, next to the number of reels and the size of your back file, is if you are a historical newspaper that goes back a long ways, one of the questions you face is whether you're going to tag your material to the article level or whether you're just going to have page level. And if you tag it to the article level, are you going to tag different kinds of articles so you can search just on the ads or search just on letters? That's the biggest decision for the places we work with, the very early American newspapers. In early American newspapers, we not only tag to the article level, but we tag 19 fields. And those fields change as the newspapers get older. They didn't have police blotters in the 1700s, but they did in 1880. Those tags are probably one of the biggest sort of bottlenecks in the system, because that you can't automate that tagging system beyond a fairly general level.
I agree with Rommel. Determining what you want to search at the article level is very important. And I spoke about derivative products. That's, for example, what allowed me to pull out all the obituaries out of newspapers across newspapers. The other layer to getting started, I would add, is the negotiation of the business arrangement around this. The revenue stream can go back to the rights holders or of the information, either to help fund the digitization itself or provide steady ongoing revenue streams that might fund other projects. So that's a negotiation also.
Is Anne? Thank you for being here so early this morning. We started looking at this and we found that the first 20 years of the magazine that there are 28,000 pages. And at some point a number of years ago, I think someone tossed out the number that was like $1 a page. And it just overwhelmed me to think at how much it might actually cost to do this. So could you talk about, is a dollar page the kind of, without the tag, this was just literally a scan in Wikipedia, that just $28,000 for 20 years, and we've got 85, 90 years at this point. Newspapers that go back that far are probably going to be bigger pages. Can you talk a little bit more about where the cost is going to come down?
Mark should check
that. As technology develops, certainly costs can come down and costs can go up. Some of the drivers on cost are what might have been traditional drivers. The more you have to do and the larger the job that a person can take on, that can drop the per page cost. So that's even true in print publishing. So a lot of what's driving it there is economics of scale, perhaps. The other hard part about this is so much of the cost depends on the state of the source material. But in general, where you've got higher quality source material, more recent, you're talking about Forbes, right? more recent material, you're not dealing with these oversized pages, some of which were printed on wallpaper and blue paper and have 12 columns. You're not dealing with that. I can't quote you an exact price, but in general, the technology is such that you could envision the cost coming down on a per page basis.
Can I ask how long ago it was you received that price?
Several years.
It's okay. I can't. Pretty much, it was all said right there. In our area, we deal a lot with partnerships. So if it's something for a newspaper archive, or I'm sure some other areas, if it's interesting to us on a revenue standpoint, we're going to be willing to talk. I can't give you a price right now either, but...
I'm just thinking for ballpark.
But ballpark...
A dollar page for an old, a long-run newspaper or magazine is overwhelming. There isn't going to be a return on investment
for a number of years on that.
Absolutely. And again, the reason I asked how long ago this was is, again, like, I've only been in the industry for just under a year. That you really surprised me by saying that. We're nowhere near that. So, okay.
I can tell you for a fact, talking to newspapers and magazine publishers all over the world, prices are going down. It's a very competitive field. All of the companies that you see represented here, up here, well, even though we're all friends, we're all competitors for this market. There are different sources to get this stuff done. Here, of course, there's always that issue of quality. There's always the issue of the interface, the GUI, search results. There are a lot of things that go into it. So it's really up to, so the client really needs to decide what it is that they're looking for, what kind of search results they're looking for, what do they want to get out of it, how do they want to ROI it, what kind of quality needs to be represented to the public, how is it going to be accessed. All those things go into it, but the costs of doing this are absolutely coming down. So if you had a quote 2 years ago for a dollar page, I'm sure that's going to be quite different today.
If I could add just one quick thing, you know, there's two trend lines here, one going down, one going up, and the one going down, to which we're referring here, is going down probably at a fairly predictable level, just because competition, cost of technology itself is cheaper. It's the line going up that is the interesting one, that an increasing amount of revenue is being earned by all sorts of publications in unanticipated ways. Newspapers are finding that genealogists like their back box. They're finding that there might be ad-driven models. But that line is much less predictable than the one going down. It's not driven by competition and outsourcing and the cost of memory storage. It's driven by new business models that are emerging in the newspaper industry. And I think it's too early, really, to know which of those models is going to be the best one. But I think it's very promising that it's beginning to become very clear that there are new ways to obtain revenue from your digital backlogs.
Laura Subarra from NPR. I have worked with most of you, except with Olive, before. A question for ProQuest. You are one of my most solid partners right now at NPR, and we depend on you for access to lots of things in underwriting. I want to know about your situation, if you can tell us something. And so I have some peace of mind that my budgeting for the 7 is all right. Because if it's not, I'll have to look out for alternatives. That is number one. And number two, again, for ProQuest, the New Yorker, the digitization of the New Yorker. If you can tell me something about it, because the way it is now, it is not working. I wanted to get rid of print New Yorkers, and I'm not, because your product is not reliable and it's not to be used on deadline. So are you ever going to have a New Yorker online on a daily basis instead of on TVs or CDs?
Okay, I'll start with the New Yorker and we'll get on to the big question. You're talking about the New Yorker that's available on CD-ROM? Yeah, that's not our product. And at least the one I know is not our product. You may know, but the rights to digitize the New Yorker online are in the hands of the New Yorker, and they are shopping those rights around. Comment on when that might happen, but they're it's a wonderful periodical for us, and they're very interested in putting that out into the world exactly the way they want to. So that is under discussion. I'll give you my card and we can talk more about that one later. The larger question about what's happening with ProQuest, and you're referring to the fact that ProQuest had announced earlier this year that it needs to restate its earnings. Back in 1999. We are disappointed that we have to do that.
we are absolutely determined that we are going to be around. ProQuest has been around for more than 60 years. If you haven't heard of this, ProQuest, as a publicly traded company, reported itself to the SAC for accounting irregularities. There are no irregularities associated with cash. The money we took in was the money we took in. Everyone's been paid. Publishers, partners, all products have been delivered. Three new products have been launched this year on schedule, two at this conference. Storm annual reports and obituaries. ProQuest will spend $50 million this year in product development capital for new product. Our creditors are not at our door. With agreements have been made with them. We have the same amount of credit that we had before. This is getting sounding pretty serious, but I do want to reassure you that we are here. We intend to see this through. We've already issued one major statement, a voluntary statement, which we think, this is out of my hands when this might come out. So it's in the hands of independent accountants. Before the end of the year, I think by that time we'll see that we have weathered the storm and the records. So I hope that helps a little bit. And in terms of the products being around, ProQuest, even independently of this, you know that dark archives and archive materials, independent holdings of databases you may have purchased or provided access to, have been a hot topic in the library world for a couple of years now. ProQuest is part of that and looking into third-party independent archival access that you purchased.
Hi, Scott Burlett with ProQuest. I'm happy to be speaking to Laura or others that have concerns that continue that conversation, but essentially Bart said that it's an accounting issue related to being a publicly traded company. I don't think it speaks to the longevity of the business and the day-to-day operations. Good question for Scott. Scott, could you talk a little bit more about your K-12 program? And I think I heard you say that you were looking to deliver all of that content for free. So talk a little bit about how you monetize that for your publishing partners.
Well, I guess we're basically, you knowing that side of the business, we're looking at most of the off-copyright material is what we're going to be going. As far as for the publishers, the reason we decided to do this is we started several microsites, or AbrahamLincoln.com, ProBaseballArchive.com, CollegeBasketballNewspaperArchive.com is in all of those. The success of those and the reaction that we received from several different libraries, we said to ourselves, well, you know, all of this material is going to start driving business to what we'll call YourNewspaperArchive.com. So for our publishers, for instance, the Syracuse Post-Standard has a marketing site with us where they're going to set the subscription rate, whether it be monthly or yearly. So what we are doing with this is we're hoping to drive those premium subscribers to not only our site where we do revenue share with our current publishers, but hopefully to some of their sites as well. So I guess you wouldn't really call it a K-12 program. We're just going to go ahead and offer it to those schools and to public libraries as well. So hopefully that answered your question.
Speaking of copyright issues, I'm just wondering, for all of you, you know, how much of what you're digitizing at this point is sort of, what's the phrase, off copyright material as opposed to copyrighted, and how, and Barbara, you had mentioned a little bit about the rights holders, how, is there a typical way that those agreements are structured? I'm just curious if you could elaborate on that a little bit.
I can give you a couple of the ProQuest models. Ours are about half and half. We're going as the string of papers. We're going for all the material that's available on that on these papers, such as the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. So the other copyright piece technically is anybody can digitize the other copyright piece of that if they had the film. But we like to enter into an agreement for the total package with the rights holders that essentially provides them on the historical newspaper file a royalty stream back to them. So they may receive it for free use within their newspaper, but we sell it in the library markets worldwide. The other way we generate dollars for them is it would be a separate agreement for the current files that they may host on their own site and have a transactional basis to allow people coming to their consumer basis back to their site to purchase an article at a time. So, and that is also structured under, it may be under a larger umbrella agreement, or it may be.
Pretty much the same here. The Redex material is, by definition, pre-copyright. It's public domain. Interestingly, we do have financial agreements with the source libraries with whom we work, except the Library of Congress, where we work with no financials involved. The newsbank material, of course, really is falls in the same category as what Mark has described. That material is owned by the newspapers. The Cassini ruling, you know, has obvious effects of what is sent out to the end users. So nothing more to happen.
I think in every project we're involved with, this, at least in the United States, this issue of copyright comes up. And typically they ask us, well, how do you deal with copyright issues? How do you deal with our photographers or our writers who are still in copyright? Still have copyright protection. And, our software allows the systems people to go in and actually gray out those areas. We deal with a lot of news magazines who publish their current editions with us, and they want to put that into an archive. And so, you know, upwards from 1923, this is an issue. So it really is. It's across the board. It's an issue everywhere. We handle it from a technology perspective.
I wanted to clarify also, just so you know, that the library access that I was talking about is all in-house. There will be no remote availability on that, too. So that's something I should have mentioned.
So I couldn't dial in from home?
That is correct. No, no. You can go to the library and you can look it up, but no, there is no remote access.
Hi, I'm Kim Leskey from NPR. So I'm here as a reference librarian who uses historical paper databases to find historical articles. And I'm curious about the problems. One of the few drawbacks is the problems and mistakes from the optical scanning, and whether there's any, what possibilities there are for correcting those. And for Mr. Kelly, when you digitize microfilm, you're just preserving those mistakes, or is there some way to get those corrected other than by librarians?
It's that old, the old adage, garbage in, garbage out. And it's since we've all been in this digital world. If you're talking about our software, we have built algorithms that recognize in the OCR process typographic characteristics, design characteristics, so we can match those and get very, very accurate XML conversion and very good results. We deal with competitors who will take that content, that analog content, and type it all in by hand, retype it in by hand. It's generally out of the country. There might be 500 people in a warehouse that have distributed manuscripts, and that's what they'll do all day long. They'll recreate millions and millions of pages by hand, and we'll get the results that way. Generally, those can be accurate, but there's a lot of issues with it. But the OCR process, the OCR technology now is very, very sophisticated. And all of us, all my colleagues here, we all use very sophisticated technology to do that. So, but again, it's going back to that archive analysis that we talked about. That we talked about the Suffolk Library System, the Sydney Morning Herald, is making sure that your content is such that you're going to get good results and you're going to get it at a good price. When I looked at this a couple of weeks ago, and you see the kinds of documents they're talking about. And there was some ad on television the other day that I saw with it looked like a priest, and there were thousands of these manuscripts behind them. It looked like they were printed in the 1400s. And that's great, but you know, what are you going to do with it? Who's going to search for that? What are those search results going to look like? They could be very flawed. So again, expectations for your newspaper, what you're planning to achieve, who you're marketing to, what's the local curiosity you're going after, what kind of search results are they looking for, and how do you ROI that? You know, if you're going to get 80, 90, 95, 100%, do you need 100% or 99.9% return on that search for X amount of dollars? So that's the thing you have to determine.
I always agree that it's correct. OCR is getting better. That too is a matter of technology and just advances in things as obscure as mathematics. But if you really want, I'll just add to that, that early American newspapers, and monographs for that matter, with their S's and their F's and their odd ligatures and the sort of eccentricities of early American typefaces, make it very difficult to achieve anywhere near the call it 99.9% accuracy that some people talk about. So it's really up to you right now. The way Redux deals with this, there's several ways. One way we do it is we actually, while we're tagging those 19 fields on every page, we key, double key, and cross match all proper names and all headlines. And in early American newspapers that didn't have headlines, we key the first couple of lines of every article in the newspaper so that you've got some key material to deal with. The other thing we're doing is, like ProQuest and like Yale, we're partnering with the Text Coordination Partnership, TCP, which is a huge partnership with many dozens of academic research libraries, is double keying a small segment, about 10-15% of these massive projects, and selecting material that would be best for academics there. So we're trying to do the best we can with what the current status of OCR is. But it is getting better. And the other thing you should make sure is that the people you partner with are continuously upgrading, not just their OCR engine, but their underlying search engines, which have a great deal to do with the efficacy of OCR. Make sure that they're continuously doing that with some guarantees of, you know, the pace at which they do it and the fact that it is part of your partnership going forward. You don't just get what you're saddled with on day one, but that it's involving.
Yeah. I'll just add that should you find something that's unacceptable, we will go back and remanufacture that page or those pages in the product. And like Rumble, we use a hybrid model of OCR and hand keying of headlines and first sentences throughout the paper, and the amount depends on the amount of the paper. We have had instances just recently in the current where we actually looked at a big portion of the finished file and then went back to the newspaper itself because the OCR was microfilm. That often works wonderfully, and it's often better to OCR than microfilm, but sometimes it doesn't, so we went back to the paper and redid it from that and filtered those changes into the database. So it's ongoing. We welcome your input on anything you find.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Vicki McCarter. I've done some research in digital preservation for newspapers now, the born digital, created digital material. And, you know, the great irony of the situation is microfilm is still the best medium for keeping newspapers for a long time. And so what I'm hearing is that the center of creating all this digital content, microfilming, and then someday you guys are going to digitize it, and that's how we're going to continue to have access to it, because it's, you know, as Chris pointed out, it's a ROI-based equation. So I guess my question to you is, how do we try to identify now the history that we are writing every day that might conceivably have some kind of market later on? I mean, we're only going to have limited resources to spend on preservation. We have to go after what we think is worth preserving. You know, it's easy to do on the old microfilm because, you know, the Kennedy assassination, the Civil War, whatever. But how do you think we should do that now? How do we start thinking about commoditizing and developing ROIs on the daily content that we're producing, because otherwise I don't know how we will ever justify the cost of trying to keep this stuff.
Question of the century.
That's the big one.
Might be too early in the day to answer.
In short, you should do it all.
Yeah.
What? Again, that's the big unknown, and that's what I was preparing for this conference. I said to some of my colleagues, what does this group want to hear about? And we keep coming back to the business model. And that's a very good point. I could be a cynic and say, well, the Bush administration, let's see, there's plenty we can talk about there at some point. But when in a newspaper, because the publishers are losing print subscribers, we all know that, and you're putting more money into your websites for closing news with that on news. Time Inc. is revamping their website big time right now, big time. That Time.com is going to be all about breaking news, columnists, so that everybody's changing. The archive component fits somewhere. It's going to be part of the ROI for the newspaper. Where it ends up, how much, whether it's going to be just the Watergates and the Civil Wars of the world, or whether it's going to be the local, we put, you know, the local story from 40 years ago in my town. You know, when I go, I was rummaging through my attic the other day and I came across a letter I had written to my girlfriend. And it was really nasty of me in 1966, but I was selling the rights to her on the weekends to somebody, you know, just kidding around, but it was signed by one of my friends who's an attorney and someone else who pretended to be an attorney. I said, gee, wouldn't this be great if this were digitized and I could send it to these people so they could look back at 1966? But so it's a good point you're making. How are we going to monetize this? What component, what segment of my local population is going to be interested in local old content? You're going to find your way there probably slowly but surely. You know what that balance is going to be from the web presence to the print product to the archive. The archive is certainly going to be a part of it, but how big it's going to be, or what you're going to edit out is even a bigger question. I don't know, but we do know from speaking to all the papers throughout the cross section of all over the world, everybody is pretty much in the same boat. There's no question about it. But they are using the advances in technology as news gatherers, which newspapers are. There's a news gathering organization. So the printed product is only one component of it now. We're using cell phone technology. We're telling our subscribers through cell phone technology that there was an accident down the street. You can see the results of that. We had a photographer out there. You can see the results. We're going to pull them back to the website. We're going to sell them. We're going to sell them an ad. We're going to talk to them about an archive. Okay. We're going to get them to buy a subscription. One of the projects we're heavily involved with is in the NIE, out in newspapers and education, in Colorado and Denver News Agency. Very, very successful program. So they're using archive technology there to educate the student population, to get the teachers to buy subscriptions back to the Denver Rocky Mountain News, etc. So it's this very incestuous kind of marketing thing that's going on, and you have to be very creative, and you have to know what your local market is about.
Vicki, I think one of the things I hear you saying is you're saying to yourself, okay, I'm putting out a newspaper today. How am I going to assure in 100 years from now that will be preserved? I mean, I think that's what I hear you saying.
Right.
One of the things that is out there now that we haven't talked about is what's called COM, computer output microfilm, where if we upload or download a pre-pressed PDF to any of our companies, and I know we all have the capability to do it, we can take that PDF and put it on to film still, so it will be preserved. And as far as heritage is concerned, that's our attitude, is the film right now is the preservation. And I've read a few of your articles over the last couple of weeks here, and so I wanted to be prepared for that, is that it seems to me that that's where we're having a problem is how do we assure that 25 years down the road that this digitized material is going to be safe, I think is where I get from you.
Actually, I have a question, because you guys are creating tons of digital content. You're creating infrastructures with all your digitized content. What are you doing to preserve your own stuff? I mean, this is what happened in academic libraries, is they went on a digitization bin to get all their rotten acidic books on film, and then they found out they were setting up yet another preservation problem with all the digitized material. So I assume that you're all taking steps with preservation metadata and those kinds of things to ensure that your own digital content is going to last for the duration. So do you want to talk about that for a minute? Maybe you know something that we can learn.
At Redux, basically, you know, since we start out with microfilm in general, we do sometimes default to digitizing newspapers from scratch. We obviously keep preservation copies of the film. We typically return copies of shooting copies, good copies. Back to the source libraries where we originally did the filming. So you got two copies there, and we make digital copies as well. I think it's pretty typical. I mean, talking about ROI and businesses, we obviously have a huge vested interest in preserving this material. And in general, our commitment to our partner libraries is that we preserve it for them and give them a copy to preserve. And it's a big part of our cost structure.
And a simple answer, for the microfilm, we have, as you know, the ProQuest Ball, but also an arrangement with the Library of Congress for ongoing preservation of the microfilm. In terms of the digital, how do we preserve our digital stuff? We're at the same frontier you are, and those are the ongoing conversations right now about Cardi Archives. Obviously, we have downloaded all of the American Periodical series on hard drives, put them somewhere.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of hard drives. There needs to be a broader-based solution across the library market. So we're active in a lot of committees and discussions about that. And the original question you asked is also, I'm sure, as you know, a broad import within the library world. A committee I sit on, the International Committee on Preservation Microfilm, just at their last meeting, turned very focused attention to this issue and sent out feelers to groups within ALA, within the National Archives Administration, because everybody is asking the same question. We're right at that crossroads. So it's important, I think, that we forge ahead together. There doesn't need to be duplicate archives and all this stuff.
Just jumping off on Richie's question real quick, what is the typical file format that you're producing in this form? Is it TIFFs? Is it different PDFs? Is it multiple formats? What is it?
We work heavily from PDF. Everything is in the olive world, everything is converted to PDF. I would say that's probably typical of all of us.
Well, if you're doing XML, it is XML behind.
Right. We take the PDF, we convert, when something is scanned, it's created into a TIFF document that's converted to PDF, and that PDF is what we call distilled into XML.
Laura,
so
she has another question.
Or
Mike. Mike.
Mike of San Antonio Express News. I wanted to know if any of y'all are investigating partnerships with either historical societies or universities to receive grant money to offset the cost of digitization.
Yes. the NP project is a good example of that. But that's a very structured product funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Library of Congress. And many of the awardees for those grants are universities that may choose to do the digitization themselves with the grant money or partner with someone like any of us here. We also have worked with state libraries and state associations to help fund the digitization of certain of the papers that we've done here.
Yes, same answer here. We do. One of the tricky bits is that when you partner with a state historical society or university and they apply for these grants, one of the tricky bits is generally the grant stipulates the material that's made available free. What we're finding is that we can still be part of that world. What's interesting for us and gratifying is that the historical archives of a handful of newspapers in Texas or Nebraska or California are in and of themselves valuable. But when we put them into a database that makes them cross-searchable with all of the other newspapers across the country during that time period, it adds value to them. So that it adds value to our product and it adds value to those papers. When you also make them cross-searchable with all of the other material that was printed in those early Texas or Nebraska towns, it adds even more value. Most people think that newspapers were the most prolifically published thing in early America. That's not true. For every newspaper published, there were 5 broadsides. So we're adding broadsides, even ephemera, to this whole thing to create a more complete picture. Basically, it's a long-winded way of saying that by putting newspapers into a broader historical context, broadsides, local histories, and so on, we're able to take material that, even though it is available free by University of Texas, we're able to add value to our products because you're getting a more cross-searchable database.
Agreed.
I
think
Laura
has achieved it. Sorry.
I just wanted to mention that 2 years ago I did the heritage project for the Syracuse newspaper, the Post Standard. So they digitized our newspaper, our microfilm, for free from 1856 to 2004, and I think now it's continuous.
Yeah, and that I was just saying.
So I don't have to think of the technologies. I'm not working there anymore. That newspaper doesn't have to worry about ROI or anything. And I need to tell you that the database is quite all right. I didn't pay anything for it. I did work for 2 years with it. And it provides, imagine access to the newspapers. And they were 2 newspapers at the time, 1850s, and then like 10 newspapers in the 1800s. And So right now, with that database, that newsroom has access to its own content, and they have new sections about today, history and all that, all the anniversaries and things, provides a rich background to today's stories. And yes, it is a regional paper, it's upstate New York. Genealogy in that area is just amazing. And I need to say this here for all of you. They are making substantial revenues by newspaper without any worry, about how much it will cost. So I just want to say thank you to Heritage. But at the same time, it's like, why can't they do it for free, and why, it's just so expensive for some other vendors? And I do understand about the quality of the products. I work with your products. But yet, the free product is okay. They use the newspaper, the microfilm. They still have the microfilm. And the PDF database. And that is okay. And most newspapers are not going to invest that much. And when you do partnership with historical societies, you have to provide access for free. You have to either give them the right to, lots of legal things. So, I think Heritage should continue in that venue. But if you hire librarians in your team, your technical team, that will really, make your product more reliable, and most news librarians will go to you. I think your company is just so good that it's totally out-of-the-box approach, very creative. But you need to have librarians. So the authority control is better, and everything is going to be with standards, bibliographic records, and all that is the base. That's it. I think you were lacking, and that gave us extra work. But overall, I totally recommend that approach. But I don't know if you are doing it still for free. But thank you. That worked. That's what I meant.
Thank you.
Well, that kind of goes back to the last question, where actually Laura spent a lot of time at the Onondaga Historical Society looking through all the papers that are not currently filmed or digitized, and we're doing some partnership with them, as well as the Post Standard itself and a couple of other entities that I don't really want to go into right now, but where we're making our money, which is really what I think the question for that is we will be charging for the filming, and we're going to be partnering with some entities that may be getting some grants where we do the filming, and in that price we will include the digitization is essentially free, and the Post Standard has a revenue marketing site where I spoke earlier that it's up to them. We do the customer service, we do all the hosting of the sites. Again, I believe all of us do the pretty much the same thing, but that's where the free came from. There, I mean, we didn't just say, hey, we're going to do it. We did. I mean, we're a for-profit company and we have to find ways to make it, so, but that's where the partnership comes into play. I think all four of us up here are willing to say that, you know, we talk about a dollar per page. Well, it depends, really. I mean, what do you want to do? What do you want to accomplish? How can we help each other? But yes, the prices are going down, and we do several things about the earlier question as well. So.
I'll just say that, you know, we are a for-profit company, so are newspapers. Newsbank has different business models with many publishers, and the more than 25 with whom we're working now and have worked have their own reasons for joining in the partnerships. They felt like it would be mutually beneficial. The models are just, I mentioned the trend lines. This trend line is going up. We're attesting to it right here. You said that newspaper is doing well. Lots of others are. I think that's why newspapers are more and more exploring these partnerships, because if they were only one-way streets, they wouldn't be happy. They're beneficial for both parties.
I think that's a good point. Consider, go back to a previous juncture in the conversation, consider carefully what you want from an enterprise like this over the long run, because there are many kinds of business models you can. And every one is a mixture of pluses and minuses, and you need to understand what suits your purposes best and how you want the whole offering of your newspaper to evolve.
Hi, I'm Jen Hamburg from the Atlanta Journal Institution, and because cost is such an issue for everyone here in this room, and it is such an expensive proposition to digitize our backups, a minute ago you were talking about the grant approach, working with the university or working with some other nonprofit entity to help fund the digitization. Could you talk a little bit about what happens to the ownership of those files if you do partner with, say, an academic institution? What happens to the copyright? What happens to, is there a revenue? What is the revenue model down the road? Is there any kind of
I was going to mention the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the NP is one example. That funding effort right now is directed towards other copyright materials. But speaking more generally, if the funding model required that the material be offered for free to a certain constituency, it's possible that you could offer it on a for sale basis to other constituencies. For example, a database could be offered for free to all higher ed libraries in the UK if the GIST, if you're familiar with that, or the British Library, had funded the digitization of that as part of their mandate to make it free. A commercial partner could then get the rights to sell that to libraries to the remainder of the world. So there are ways to kind of serve both masters.
And I was actually thinking past the out copyright.
I think there can be. That's a little more complicated. Of course, the rights remain with the rights holder, and the revenues remain. They would certainly get a part of the royalty structure. But even the rights holder themselves could seek grant funding to do what they wanted to do, and there may or may not be
stipulations that it's not agree to a certain condition.
I have another question about sort of economic models. Just in your experience, how many papers or products do go with a subscription model as opposed to selling ads? Or is it a combination? Or I'm just wondering if there's, it seems to me that it would be more subscription-based at this point, but do you see that radically changing in the future?
I'm not subscriptions, and there's also a database purchase model that is not advertising related at all. On instances where we support the newspaper itself offering on a transactional basis access to articles that has that can advertise. But that's been on paper.
Same for us. The historical material is generally sold rather than subscribed to the model that we offer. But obviously, I know you're asking about more modern material. I think it's too early to tell how that model is going, although I suppose there are probably more bets on the advertising end of things. There's a Google and all sorts of ad-driven phenomena. But I think it's too early to tell, perhaps.
In the Olive model, the publisher always owns the content, and so what you will find in most of our customers, they offer a variety. Either they sell ads to that around that content, or in the case of several of them, they offer day passes, month passes, yearly passes. If you go to thescotsman.com, it's a very interesting archive. If anybody would like the password, I can tell you after the session, I'll give you the password to that. But that's an excellent model where they're cross, they're selling subscriptions and they're selling advertising on that, and it's article level, page level segmentation. It's a very nice archive, very profitable archive.
Yeah, and we're all subscription. We don't go with the ads at all. Most of it's historical, so we don't do a lot of current.
Whoever gets to the microphone first.
My name is Leslie Norman from the Wall Street Journal. My question is more of just a personal curiosity. When you have to deal with historical newspapers that have not been microfilmed and you've got the old paper and it's falling apart, as a developer, an interest in scrapbooking and bookmaking over the past couple of years,
I think we have to. I mean, when you're trying to digitize film and digitize every newspaper printed up to 1820, you're going to have to deal with the bad ones as well as the good ones, and many of them are in pretty bad shape. You face the question then whether it isn't better sometimes to digitize from scratch and blow it back to, you know, preservation microfilm, because sometimes that's actually better for the material. But the answer to your question is, I think for all of us, we have people because we must have people who are preservationists and who can piece together, if you will, some of these badly foxed and broken newspapers.
Long histories of dealing with other printed materials and the handling of them and the scanning of them and the microfilm. There's a lot of expertise out there. And I think you need to go to the presentation, which I think is coming up this morning by the University of Kentucky on their NDMP project, because I think Mary Molinaro describes your papers having been chewed by rats. And how they filmed around the rat holes in the page.
Sounds like a challenge. I think Eli has a question.
Hello, my name is Eli Edwards, and I'm currently unaffiliated. But I used to work for Stanford University, and I used to work for Mr. Kale at the Internet Archive, one of the people interviewed, and he knows a lot already. Article in the New York Times, and I think I heard Barb say that in terms of preservation, that you don't want lots of copies all over the place. And at both the Internet Archive and at Stanford, the model for digitization is, yes, we want copies all over the place.
Lots of copies keep stuff safe.
Yes.
I was speaking of our journal.
Okay, sorry. So my question is, how different is the newspaper or the microfilm digitization niche? How different it is from other types of digitization models, basically? And can you, do you get together with other digitization companies, whether nonprofits or commercial, you trade ideas? How much is transferable in terms of your models for how to deal with material, whether I'm talking about books or ephemera or digital materials or newspapers?
I think what I hear there too, and what you're saying is, like you said, the more areas you keep it, the better off you are in case something happens. As far as digital is concerned, what we do is we, of course, store it in three different areas, whether it be different servers or on CD. And as far as the libraries are concerned, you can certainly have copies as well. I mean, that's not an issue. So I think from my standpoint is we agree with that. As far as having it in several different areas in the event something happens. But again, we don't feel that that's a true preservation model from our standpoint. But on the digital side, yes, we store it in separate, we store the same TIFF file in several different areas. Or again, the PDF file as well.
I don't know if I can speak exactly how different it is, but all the enterprises that are rooted in microfilm, and that having been such a standard in the library world for so long, have a lot of standards attached to them that have evolved out of how people use them. And I think somebody mentioned the preservation metadata standards that are evolving in the library world right now. A lot of that applies to digitization for microfilm, and that's one instance where people in different areas working on similar kinds of products would look to a common point to unite some of their work, and that would make that work understandable and kind of permeable to information seekers in the years to come. So we do feel a responsibility to understand how the library and the preservation community at large is trending.
Each October, Redux has a gathering in Chester, Vermont, where we have our production headquarters. It's called the Redux Digital Institute, where we get 30 or 40 key librarians and discuss seminal issues relating to profession, and one of them is always preservation, and the lots folks, I forget exactly which one, from Stanford, lots of copies, keeps that safe. The OLA movement is represented this year in Vermont to discuss how that whole program is going. We don't do anything different in terms of the number of copies we keep, but we're paying attention to that. It's an ingenious way to ensure preservation on a very widespread level.
I'm Megan Waters from the Miami Herald. I'm curious in your experience dealing with different papers, if you help them locate the preservation quality microfilm, is that so essential to high resolution notebooks?
I think we'll help in any way we possibly can. It's a matter of finding them. With Stars and Stripes, I know they had master film all over the place. It's just a matter of locating it. We don't, you know, if we don't have it in our vault, you know, we'll do everything we can to help you, I think.
But the ProQuest might.
Yeah, if I don't have it, ProQuest might have it.
Actually, I would get the same answer. And then we call Henry Snyder in California, who, as you may know, is literally diving his dumpsters to haul microfilm out for small companies that have folded. So there is, all of us are on the alert to know where that stuff is and save it.
You know, a surprising amount of it is still where it's listed in Clarox Brigham's and Winifred Gregory's bibliographies of early American newspapers. They list, and the first one goes to 1820, the second one goes to 1936. Yeah, surprisingly comprehensive, and on a state-by-state basis, it says everywhere in the United States that copies of these early newspapers existed. Now, Florida, a lot of modern, a lot of, you know, young states, as it were, are not going to be listed back in there. Although Bradbury is on the 1936, we have plenty of material. Typically, where you find these things are in the, you know, regional historical societies. A surprising number of these are at the American Antiquarian Society, Wisconsin Historical and Library of Congress. That's why we partner, you know, so far primarily with them.
I knew I could set still as I go from your side. Excuse my back, but the question I have is really more directed at all of you. And it has to do with some of what we talked about over dinner last night, the news anchor. In our current climate in the publishing world, money's tight, obviously, cuts are being made. Many of you are victims, or your staff have been victims of that. One of the things that I struggled with at the Tampa Tribune is getting, I spent my entire 6 years there, from literally the day I walked in the door until I left, talking about the need to digitize. And we had some very good reasons for doing that, particularly there in Tampa. But the ROI question always came up, and my answer to the top management of Media General was ROI can't be measured on a monetary return, but this is our core product. And in Tampa's situation, they're just about, I was telling some people yesterday, they're in the middle of renovating a lobby in the adjacent building, the older building. And God knows it needs it. I mean, it's sad looking at not a good representation of what that organization is about when you walk in. But that's a lobby. It started out with saying we're going to spend $6 million to renovate this lobby, which is maybe 14 by 14. So when you think about that, and I don't begrudge doing that, but you think about your product being the core of why you exist. You know, and how do you, and I said to the executive editor who's writing a capital budget request right now, an emergency one, because our microfilm is full of mold and vinegar syndrome and all sorts of other issues that play into that. And I said, you know, I'm just going to say it to you straight, Janet, and let you figure out the nice way to say to our corporation, the people in Richmond, Virginia, how do you put a price on your core product? You know, and why does that come down to dollars? And when you look at, an entryway into your business with $6 million to do, to renovate, that you're going to be doing all over in 10 years, and then you think about your core product that you can be, you know, totally digitized and do it once, at least the back files. And then the cost, ongoing cost, of course, is far less expensive. How can you, with a good conscience, not do that? You know, and I just, you know, and I'd like to know, you know, how do we say this? How do you all say this to the people in your organizations? You know, aside from shameless, you know, making them feel guilty over it, how do you say that? To convince them to do that kind of thing. I mean, we all know our industry is changing. My former industry is changing our industry. I still consider myself a news librarian at heart, and always will be. And, you know, have you convinced them that, you know, because publishing is changing, you have to do this. You know, getting it in a digital format opens all sorts of ideas, and this isn't a shameless sales plug by any stretch of the imagination. I want to ask all of you know, if you have some great ideas out there for how to bring this to the forefront. And my question last night over dinner was, in this climate, how, financial climate for news organizations, how do you get this at the top of priority? I mean, you have to do it now. And is it to say, you do it now, you protect the core product, you get it in a format that opens up all the online news, what it is, and things going in that direction? Is it just
Is that how you did it at the top? I'd love to know if some of you have bought this and talked this through some with your organizations that can get it from, yeah, we want to do that someday, to at the top, we must do this now. Jody, I think we need to have a whole other session on how to pitch this to management. Really made a convincing case, so perhaps that would be a great session for next time. But we, unfortunately, are out of time today. I would really like to thank Barb and Rimmel and Chris and Scott for being here today and patiently answering our questions.
Thank you.
So, big round of applause again.
Thank you very much, all of you.
Did you take work?
Well, we're going to find out.
Try your business cards if you have them. Oh, thank you very much.
Barb?